Hello, and welcome to the New Academy Series podcast, a monthly series in which we talk with our fellow English Department NTTs about their professional lives and all things specialized faculty. I'm Mary Lucille Hayes.
And I'm Dave Morris. Our guest today is Kyle Garten-Gunling. Kyle is lecturer in English here at U of I, and like many of us, he teaches Ret 105 and every once in a while, occasionally, an introductory lit course. He graduated from the University of Maryland College Park with his PhD in English in 2013. Little known fact, Kyle did his undergrad here in the English building from 2003 to 2007, which means John, Mary, and I were present for his entire undergrad experience, and yet we didn't know him at all, which should tell you quite a bit about this department. After doing some part-time teaching at multiple institutions, Kyle started as an NTT here in 2015. Just in time for the NTFC strike.
That's right.
Yeah.
fun times.
Yeah. His research interests are in the area of post-1945 multi-ethnic literature and religion. So welcome, Kyle. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. We're also joined today by a friend of the podcast, editor of the podcast, and fellow NTT, John Claiborne.
Hello. This is the voice of John Claiborne. So am I like the official editor now? Is that my title?
I figured since
I feel like friend of the podcast is kind of like a demotion.
Oh, I mean, no.
Since the series is funded by no one, all we really have to offer you is a title for your CV.
Okay.
So, podcast editor. Yeah.
What about producer? A little bit loftier.
The New Academy Series podcast is produced by whoever happens to have the cell phone to record it on that day.
You can declare yourself the leading financial backer.
Yes.
All of the equipment supplied by John Claiborne.
Today, John, Dave, and I will be talking with Kyle about his new book, Enlightened Individualism, Buddhism and Hinduism in American Literature from the Beats to the Present, from OSU Press. In it, Kyle argues that even though works by Kerouac, Walker, Kingston, and others wrestle with issues of exoticism and appropriation, their characters are also meaningfully challenged and changed by Asian faiths. These literary adaptations, then, can help Americans re-envision individualism in a more transcendent and cosmopolitan context. So, beyond that, for our listeners who haven't had probably haven't yet read your book, can you sort of encapsulate what your main argument is?
Sure. So, to give a little background, normally, when we think of Asian religions in the United States, we tend to think of it as kind of a fad. People might do some secularized mindfulness meditation, or they might do some very secularized postural yoga as a form of exercise. But what I'm saying is that, especially in contemporary American literature, there's actually an overlooked and very serious effort to deeply synthesize philosophies and ideas from Asian religions, especially Buddhism and Hinduism, with American ideals of liberty and individual rights coming from the European Enlightenment. So in a way, my book is about how American literature is trying to create surprising syntheses between the seemingly two incompatible enlightenments, the uppercase E Enlightenment of Europe on the one hand, which promotes individual autonomy, but then also the transcendence of self in the Buddhist and Hindu Enlightenment on the other.
Okay.
Interesting. And can you tell us about some of the writers and texts you engage with and why you chose them?
Sure. So, for me, the real turning point is with the Beat Generation in the 1950s. So those are the writers who, for the first time, really made Asian religions visible to the mass of American culture, and they did so in a way that linked Asian religions in the U.S. to countercultures. This was not similar to how previous American engagements with Asian religions proceeded. If you look back at the transcendentalists like Emerson and Thoreau, or some of the modernists like T.S. Eliot or Ezra Pound, there was always something very kind of genteel and abstract about the way that they were interested in the Asian religions. But the Beats turned it into a countercultural phenomenon and they used some of their own versions of Zen philosophy as a kind of license for their own delinquency as a form of freedom and spontaneity. So I start with the Beat Generation, talking in particular about Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, and then also Tom Robbins, who's a little bit later but still kind of carries on the Beat legacy. I also look at some of the kind of opposition to the Beat movement, including J.D. Salinger and Robert Pirsig, both of whom shared the Beat's interest in Asian religions, but didn't like the whole countercultural aspect. They wanted to make Asian religions more palatable to mainstream audiences. I also consider how even some postmodern writers who you wouldn't expect to really be that interested in religions, since they're always, you know, skeptics trying to undermine anything ultimate, they're still surprisingly invested in both Asian religions and American ideals, and I look at some texts by Thomas Pynchon and Don DeLillo. One thing, though, that this list of writers shows is that it's very white, but it's not all white, and so I also noticed that recently, there's been an increase in African-American writers who concern themselves with Asian religions, and the two that I really focus on are Alice Walker and Charles Johnson, the latter of whom won the National Book Award for his novel Middle Passage, which is a wonderful novel. And those writers really make a very interesting attempt to kind of imagine Asian religions in a kind of disguised form presented indirectly through African or black wisdom figures without naming the explicit Hindu or Buddhist origins of the philosophies that those characters espouse, in a very interesting kind of bid for making Asian religions more ethnically authentic for an African American audience. The most surprising thing I found, though, when researching these authors is I wondered, how come there aren't more Asian American writers discussing Asian religions? And it turns out that there are, they just haven't been doing it for as long. So starting at around 1989, 1990, then you start to see more Asian American fiction writers really try to revisit their own Asian religious heritage in the context of trying to navigate Asian and American identities. And I look in particular at Maxine Hong Kingston as an example of this, and also the lesser-known Vietnamese-American novelist Lan Cao. So those are the main writers that I look at.
Great. I was wondering, you mentioned that a lot of these authors, the Beats, postmodernist authors, are white, and you mentioned whiteness a lot in your introduction. So I was wondering, what is it about sort of white identity in the U.S. that makes them receptive to these ideas? Maybe, I don't know. I'm just exploring here.
Yes, so that's a very complicated issue, and it would take a lot to really answer the question thoroughly. Mm-hmm. But I'll just sort of say a few things, and you can make of them what you will. So if you go back to the 19th century, when Americans were just beginning to learn about Asian religions from the Transcendental translations, there's a huge split between the white East Coast Boston intellectual crowd and their version of Asian religions, contrasting from the sort of West Coast Chinese immigrant communities and later Japanese immigrant communities in California, and in particular the San Francisco area. And so, and ever since that time, there's been this gap between the kind of white Buddhism, mainly from the Boston area, versus the more ethnic immigrant Buddhism from the San Francisco area. And they have certain shared characteristics. So the white New England Buddhism tends to be very abstract. It tends to focus on Buddhist metaphysics and Hindu philosophy and solitary meditation as the most important spiritual practice, whereas the Asian immigrant communities tend to focus more on ritual and deity devotions and chanting and prayers and so on. And when American adapters would talk about Buddhist and Hindu influences, they thought of themselves as recovering a more pure version of these religions, almost like they were better at it than the ethnic immigrant communities who are following this kind of debased or superstitious form of it.
Yeah.
So their sense of whiteness, I think, contributed to this feeling of we have the authority as rational white people to strip away all of these superstitions, much in the same way that they viewed the kind of Protestant Reformation as stripping away Catholic superstitions.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
It reminds me, too, of Thomas Jefferson's Bible and Thomas Jefferson's Koran.
Exactly.
Like, this is, I'm going to recover the real part of this. But I was also thinking, as you were answering, that in part this is also linked to how different populations of people would encounter some of these texts. And what I wondered is if there was a correspondence between this interest, literary interest in Buddhism and Hinduism, and the commercialization of these in the publishing industry, where suddenly you're getting books with names like, I don't know, The Wisdom of the East, and you cite sometimes Rahula's What the Buddha Taught,
yes,
which is basically exactly this. It's that stripped down Buddhist metaphysics. Here's the doctrine of no self, and then at the end, here's the fire sermon.
Yeah.
And so I was curious about how, whether there was any correspondence in that, or if you saw those in the text. And if that's not part of your research, I totally understand that.
Well, it's definitely related. So, again, there's no simple answer. These are great questions. What's so good about them is how rich they are. But I'll take a stab at some parts of that. So I want to draw a distinction, first of all, between having a more abstract, metaphysical, philosophical approach versus having a superficial approach. Or a commercial approach. I think those aren't necessarily the same thing. So the writers that I'm focusing on have a very kind of abstract metaphysical approach, but they're not really superficial or commercial. They're actually quite intellectually and spiritually serious about the ideas that they're thinking about. But they do have a lot of cultural blind spots. And I think that's related to, but slightly distinct from, the phenomenon of things like yoga and mindfulness becoming so commercialized. So if you look at how Zen has been adapted in the U.S. in particular, you have a very philosophically serious book like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert Pirsig, and then that book inspires a bunch of book titles where Zen and the Art of Fill in the Blank becomes this template for whatever, Zen and the Art of Corporate Leadership, Zen and the Art of Marketing, and now it's becoming very commercial and is losing a lot of the philosophical seriousness that Robert Pirsig already had. So I think that a lot of the commercial versions of Buddhist and Hindu kind of cultural trappings are pretty well known to most people. So what I want to look at is the more overlooked hidden seriousness of a lot of these literary writers who many times inspire the eventual commercializations that come later, but they actually start out by creating much more kind of deep and serious and introspective forms of cross-cultural synthesis.
Also on the other end from commercialism, I wrote down a quote from your introduction where you talk about writers that selectively transmit and adapt some aspects of Buddhism and Hinduism, but not others, often ignoring the lived religions of Asians and Asian Americans and indulging in visions of Asian religions as relics to be revived. And that sentence there reminded me of ways in which people often relate culturally and religiously to Native Americans, and I wondered if that's a connection you've thought about.
That's absolutely a connection I've thought about. In fact, in my introduction, I cite a couple of philosophers, Wilson and Brunk, who argue that even though, yes, we do have the freedom of religion, a concern for the cultural origins of traditions should place ethical limits on the exercise of those rights. In other words, we should be careful about making sure that we're actually trying to understand the religion that we're interested in and not just take it on as a kind of hobby or frivolous excuse for whatever we wanted to justify in our own selves anyway. And Wilson and Brunk were mainly talking about Native American religions when they wrote that. But I also thought that it was very relevant to what I was dealing with here. Of course, one distinction is the fact that in the case of Native American religions, you're talking about a population that was displaced through a process of territorial conquest and then marginalization and relegation to small reservations. So there's a very kind of direct imperialistic legacy behind that. That's slightly different from American adaptations of Asian religions, which are imports from countries that our relationship to that territory isn't quite the same one of like a direct kind of displacement. Even though there are, of course, colonial and imperial involvements in the U.S. occupation of Japan, for example, which helped facilitate a lot of the post-war interest in American Buddhism from Japan as well. But I definitely think it's worth thinking about how do these largely white writers relate to religions from ethnic minority communities, whether it's Asian, Asian American, or Native American.
I'm curious, kind of backtracking to the title of the book, we've talked a lot about Buddhism so far. I was surprised to see Hinduism in the title as well, as if they're on equal footing as far as influence goes.
Yes.
And I was wondering, like, if you could talk more about Hinduism and its influence and just elaborate a little bit more on that.
Absolutely. So, historically speaking, Hinduism and Buddhism are very closely related because Hinduism is the religion out of which Buddhism originated. So a lot of the philosophical ideas are basically the same. This prioritization of a complete transcendence of all subject-object distinctions. This ideal of the erasure of the self through meditative realization. Also the idea of karma and reincarnation as a process of cyclic suffering that we want to become free from. Mm-hmm. These are ideas common to both Hinduism and Buddhism that are very important to most of the writers that I'm looking at. So accordingly, it's not too surprising, it turns out, that if you look at the American writers who are invested in these Asian religions, they frequently talk about both Buddhism and Hinduism mm-hmm. in their writings. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Transcendentalist magazine, The Dial, their column Ethnical Scriptures in the 1840s and 50s had a lot of texts from both Hinduism and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And then, in the 20th century, somebody like J.D. Salinger quoted Hindu and Buddhist texts and sages very often in close proximity to one another because of the focus on the philosophical kinship between those Hindu and Buddhist kind of ideals of spiritual growth. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of similarity. I think the Buddhist influences are a little more visible simply because Buddhism is the religion that has this one founding figure, the Buddha, that you can, make a statue of and hang a poster of on your wall or something. Hinduism is a much more diffuse religion. There's no individual founder of Hinduism. And American kind of sympathizers are much more reluctant to hang up pictures of Hindu gods on their door than they are of the Buddha. That's a very interesting issue. But the point is, the influences are very closely related because of the philosophical kinship between those religions, historically speaking.
It's also possible. It's also easier to pretend there is no god at all in Buddhism, even though there are many gods.
Yes, exactly.
It's much harder to strip that away from Hinduism.
Well, but they do try. So in J.D. Salinger, again, he likes to really focus on the version of Hindu philosophy called Advaita Vedanta, which is the very kind of non-dual transcendent school of Hinduism. It's not the only school. For example, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, known as the Hare Krishnas, have a much more kind of personal deity conception of ultimate reality. Mm-hmm. But due to the efforts of various influencers like Salinger, and then before him Swami Vivekananda, Sri Ramakrishna, or also Paramahansa Yogananda, those figures all promoted a very non-dual and non-kind of deity-focused version of God. Or to rephrase that, their definition of God was not personal. It was a kind of impersonal universal principle. And that is the version of Hinduism that has become the dominant perception of Hinduism in the U.S., even though it's not certainly the only kind of Hinduism there is.
Kyle, I've been curious about where did your interest in Asian religions originate? Is it through the literature or somewhere else?
Well, it's both. Okay. So I'm a Buddhist. I've been practicing Buddhism since 2005. Okay. And when I was, getting really interested in the field of literary studies as an undergraduate, I was interested in religion and literature more broadly. And in the classes I was taking, I noticed, oh, there's a lot of religious themes in these various novels that we're looking at, and nobody's talking about them. And then, sure enough, just a few years later, then the scholarship started coming out with Amy Hungerford, John McClure, and other folks like that. So then I thought, okay, I'm really onto something. So then I realized, well, there's been a lot of great work kind of laying the groundwork for reviving interest in religion in American fiction, especially in the contemporary period. So what can I add to this? What new direction can I take? And as a Buddhist and somebody who knows a fair amount about Hinduism as well, I noticed things in the novels that were like references or patterns of philosophical influences that other readers would not have noticed. And I started to realize a trend. And I noticed that time and again, these writers were doing something very surprising. Instead of just critiquing American individualism by using Asian philosophies as the kind of opposite of that and saying that, you know, we need to be non-dual and non-individualistic, just like Buddhist and Hindu philosophy, instead of the American individualist ideology, they actually did something very different. They tried to link those views together, even though they seemed to be incompatible. And they tried to do that by using the ambiguity inherent in the word freedom. So you have the American freedom to pursue happiness in Jefferson's terms. But then you have the Buddhist and Hindu freedom to be free from your own individual desires that make you perpetually unsatisfied. These are two very kind of contradictory sounding ideas. But a lot of American writers put a lot of effort into trying to make them fit together by reforming American individualism through these Asian philosophies to turn American identity into something more humane, more compassionate, and more cosmopolitan without abandoning it altogether. So that's what really interested me.
That's funny, because right around the same time I was becoming interested in literature and religion, similarly encountering ideas that I felt like nobody was talking about, patterns and whatnot, although it also helped that it was the Bush administration and that very secularized but nonetheless recognizably fundamentalist Christian rhetoric was being deployed to justify invading Iraq. And And the other thing is, when you were saying that, I was reminded that when I took theory for the first time as a grad student, and we were talking about structuralism, and we were talking about, well, Saussure, Swiss, linguistics, et cetera, and I was like, what the hell are you talking about? This is just on Ottoman.
Yes.
This is just structure. The karmic constituents make the illusion of the self, and... And that was a good day in Bob Parker's class.
That's cool. In fact, one thing I also noticed along similar lines was not just about like the metaphysical nature of the self in general. And other philosophers have already observed like some similarities between, you know, Derridian deconstruction and the Buddhist critique of the self, for example. There are books already out about this. But I happened to notice that there's a very specific coincidental convergence between the philosophy of language of Saussure and also a very obscure 13th century Tibetan intellectual named Sakya Pandita, who argued 800 or 900 years before Saussure did that there is no inherent relationship between the signifier and the signified and that language is arbitrary. So he very specifically anticipated that exact idea from structuralist linguistics many centuries before. So I thought that was a pretty cool thing to notice.
Just anecdotally, I don't know if this is an apocryphal quote or what, but apparently Heidegger once said that when he listened to, or he read a book or listened to D.T. Suzuki speak, and he said, this guy is saying he's saying everything I'm trying to say, and he's doing it much simpler than I am.
Yeah.
But there are, a lot of parallels between that existential philosophy of Heidegger and Buddhism.
I think Buddhism is a lot more optimistic. So there are important distinctions to be made, but there are a lot of good convergences too. Mm. And I think that's why a lot of what appeals to Buddhism and also Hinduism to American writers and sympathizers is if you're an American who's disaffected from Christianity, now these Buddhist and Hindu religions start to look like a much more rational alternative without all of the superstition of of God and the problems of miracles and all that sort of thing. Admittedly, that conception that Asian religions are this kind of more philosophically reasonable, rational version kind of overlooks the more kind of pre-modern and supernatural worldviews that a lot of those religions had. But that is how they have become received in European intellectual traditions.
What strikes me, there's also the there's a countervailing sort of fundamentalist or evangelical Christian notion of saying exactly the opposite, that Christianity, save the miracles of Jesus, which is the special case, is the rational, non-miraculous thing, and that everybody else's is primitive, superstitious, and cults, as they called it in my father's church.
Right. So there's a lot of parallels. In fact, there's you might have heard of the kind of celebrity religion scholar Stephen Prothero, who wrote a book called The White Buddhist, Protestant Buddhism and the Odyssey of Henry Steele Olcott. And without going into too much detail, one of Prothero's points is that when 19th century kind of white Buddhist sympathizers learned more about Buddhism and wrote books about it, they drew parallels between what they saw as the Buddha's rejection of the Hindu superstition that he grew out of and the Protestant Reformation getting rid of the Catholic superstition. So yes, that connection has a very long-standing link in the minds of American and European adapters of Buddhist and Hindu ideas.
So, can we switch gears?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Okay. So I know some people who listen to our podcast, and that's not very many people, but some people who do, and some people who come to the series, are grad students who might be curious about the process of actually making a book.
So yeah.
Finding a publisher, turning your dissertation into a book, and that sort of thing. Did this start as a dissertation? And the second question is, what do you wish you would have known? What would you tell somebody about finding a publisher and about this process that you wish you would have known before it started?
Sure. So first of all, this did start as a dissertation, but the book is very, very different from the dissertation. So if I were to tell graduate students listening that you should expect an enormous amount of revision, I'm probably not saying anything they haven't already been told by their own faculty mentors and supervisors. That's a pretty understood fact. In terms of finding a publisher, I actually feel like I was very well prepared to navigate that process because I had good mentorship both from folks at the University of Maryland and also people here at the University of Illinois that I reconnected with and helped me write my book proposal and gave me ideas for presses that might be interested in my book. What I think was the most important thing for me was to find a publisher who was running a book series that was already about my topic. So in this case, Ohio State University Press has a series called Literature, Religion, and Post-Secular Studies, which my book is a part of now. And it turned out that what I was able to pitch them was that my book would be the first book in their series that was not mainly about Christianity. So I was able to have a good balance between continuing their interest in the post-secular trends in academic literary studies, but also offering something new. So I think that finding that right fit was the most important thing in terms of locating a publisher.
Cool.
Well, can I downshift again and ask you about juggling your teaching as an NTT with the writing of the book, with everything else you have to juggle?
Absolutely. So it didn't really feel like that much of a juggling act.
Okay.
Because the truth is, I enjoy having a lot of variety in the things that I do. I'm not the kind of person who just wants to write for 5 or 6 hours a day. That's just not what works for me. I like doing some teaching, doing some lesson planning, doing some reading, doing some writing. To me, it's all a part of the life of the mind, and I like that variety. So it felt like a very comfortable balance to me. I usually wrote, you know, for an hour or two in the mornings on days when I didn't teach, and sometimes on the weekends. And that was pretty much good enough. Like, I didn't feel like I had to work too hard to get everything done. So to me, I liked having those variety of different tasks and responsibilities.
Is there anything you wish you had had, since you didn't necessarily need lots and lots of release from teaching time or a sabbatical or anything?
You know, I don't really think so. I actually felt very comfortable with the level of resources that I had available to me, with the level of time that it took to write this. Since I'm not, you know, a medievalist or somebody who does non-American literatures, I didn't really need any kind of, you know, travel funding to go to some archive somewhere. And I didn't need to, like, you know, look at a lot of original author's notes or manuscript ambiguities or anything like that. So my research process was a fairly straightforward one that could be done pretty, you know, comfortably just through the typical academic databases and library checkouts and the occasional interlibrary loan request. So the process of researching and getting everything I needed, to me, went pretty smoothly.
As you're going through the publication process, like, what were you hoping, or I guess now, like, what are you hoping this book will do for your professionally? Are you, like, do you still want to get a tenure track job, or?
Well, I do want a tenure track job, but rather than focus on what I want this book to do for me, I'm more interested in what I want the book to do for the profession and for scholarship.
Right.
So I think that the influence of Asian religions to ideas of American identity is a really overlooked facet of this. And I think that by tracing out some of these kind of hidden lines of influences, I could potentially help, you know, ideally promote ideals of American identity that can sort of reduce or reform some of the most callous excesses or tendencies to which American identity is sometimes prone. The more extreme individualism is how we got into a lot of the problems that we have now. And I think that, you know, I am kind of sympathetic to a lot of what the writers I study are doing, even though I also have my criticisms of them. I think that if we paid more attention to some of these ways of trying to reform American individualism through Asian and Buddhist ideals, we'd be better off in a lot of ways. And so I want to kind of try to promote that as much as possible.
Yeah, and that seems to tie in a lot with the environmental movement. And recently we've had I don't know if it'll come up for vote. It probably won't. But the resolution, the Green New Deal resolution.
Yes.
And I know that writers like Gary Snyder were very influential in the field of eco-criticism.
Yes.
But maybe more importantly, the environmental movement.
Absolutely. And so you have people like Gary Snyder, and then you also have the entire engaged Buddhism movement that it was kind of founded by the Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh, but has become popular among certain sectors of kind of nerdy Americans who wants to apply Buddhist philosophy to political activism. And so that a lot of what I'm talking about is related to that same kind of agenda.
So you were here as an undergrad.
That's right.
And you've been here for a few years as an NTT.
Uh-huh.
How do I ask that, this? What's it like seeing it from the other side? Did you want to come back here, or was it a great opportunity, and so you jumped on it? Like, how did that go?
Well, let me see if I can answer those questions kind of one piece at a time. So first of all, what is it like teaching in the classrooms that I used to be a student at? It's bizarre. It's really surreal. It's a strange feeling to walk into this room and remember, oh yeah, I used to sit over there and look, you know, into the front of the classroom.
And I'm sure the room has not been painted since then.
The rooms are exactly the same.
Perfectly preserved.
There is absolutely zero change whatsoever. Some of the digital equipment has been slightly upgraded, but the fixtures of the rooms, the desks, the chairs, the walls, are all the same. I guess some of the lights have been improved in some cases, but pretty much exactly the same.
Kyle, it's the same as in 1979 when I was a student here.
Yeah, so that's I'm not surprised at all to hear that. It definitely has that feel to it. There's a lamp in my office that looks like it's been there since 1943. It has this really old, like, giant metal base that weighs like 50 pounds or something. It's this big fluorescent lamp. Anyway, this building has a very distinctive character, let's say. And but it's a good opportunity. I like being able to come back here and, you know, reconnect with faculty who used to be my teachers and now I'm their junior colleague. And I also like to meet people like you, Dave, who, you know, I probably should have known as an undergraduate, yeah, but didn't get the chance to, because there wouldn't have been much of a situation in which we would have interacted.
No.
But now that I'm here again, I'm really happy to be in this position. And in terms of how this relates to the job market, like how did I get this position, it's kind of funny because I was applying to all kinds of jobs, you know, anything I felt like I was qualified for, and this opportunity came up and I applied to it in, I want to say, April of 2015. Then in May, I got a rejection letter. Then in late July, I got a phone call that said, oh, wait, we have higher than expected enrollments. Can we interview you? And then I got the job, you know, and had to kind of scramble to move here from, I was living in Pennsylvania at the time.
Oh,
and I had to move here in like 3 weeks. And it was kind of crazy. But once I got here, I really enjoyed the position. I feel like my day-to-day working conditions are very good, and I get to do the things that I want to do and teach good students, so I feel pretty positively about it.
I just realized I'm the only person in the room who did not go to college here.
I went here as an undergrad from 2000 to 2002.
So I just missed you.
Yeah. And we probably wouldn't have met anyway because there were like 2,000 English majors at the time. And
those were the days.
Unlike now, when there were 12.
Those were the days when there were just thousands of us.
We probably would have taken some upper-level seminars together. You know, we might have had similar interests.
Yeah, we probably would recognize each other as the smart ones.
Well, I try.
That's my narcissism.
I try not to be so highfalutin about it, but
neither does John. He's just being.
But I remember, when I coming back here to teach as a grad student in 2004. Having that same sort of surreal experience, and just feeling like I'm back here, and
I feel a bit of envy that you all would have known where the bathrooms were, because just that took me a while to figure out. Also, the light in my office didn't work when I originally went into it.
I still have trouble figuring this building out. There's a steady trickle of people who knock on my door and say, excuse me, can you tell me how to find such and such? And I don't always know the answer. It's not a given that I can give them directions.
The third floor is extremely interesting.
No, they got someone to number the rooms who confirmed all the cliches about English majors not understanding numbers. Really bothers me.
But I think just before you came in 2015. I think just
That's
before
right.
you came, we got rid of all the overhead projectors.
Okay.
And they were all sitting in a pile out on Wright Street. Do you remember that? There were like three dozen.
Yeah. I looked into this. And
I have a photo, I think.
The concept of an overhead projector comes from, it's a late 19th century technology. It sort of intersects with the origin of film. These magic lantern projections that they would do back then. But the modern overhead projector was created during World War II. And so basically we just recently got rid of like a 1940s technology.
So maybe in another 40 years the English department will upgrade to stay up to date to about 70 years behind whatever the cutting edge is.
Well, we also recently got rid of our TVs on rolling carts. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember if you taught, you wanted to show a movie and you taught in a different building, you would have to take the TV cart down the ramp out by the, I remember wheeling it over to Illini Hall once. God, this place is weird.
So just one more thing about, like, so I asked you about what you got out of it professionally, and I do think, like, when I was writing my book, I needed like some motivation, because I was like, I'm probably not going to get a tenure track job, so that can't be the motivation here, and it was hoping that my book would do something in the scholarship on civil rights and African-American literature and eco-criticism, but that it might, you know, do something more in the world. I don't know. I'm still figuring what that might be. But I also got a personal satisfaction out of it from being like, okay, well, you know, I'm an NTT. You know, I'm not just going to give up on this book. I'm going to go ahead as though I am an assistant professor and publish this project that I've spent 10 years on.
Yeah.
I was wondering, like, what kind of, what it did for you personally or spiritually.
Absolutely. Even. So, of course, my spiritual interests are all bound up in this project. And just on a personal level, I find this really fascinating, and it's really cool to be able to come up with an idea that has not been promoted before, and to illuminate a facet of literary history that nobody else has examined in the same way. Mm-hmm. You know what that's like, because in your case, having a book that illuminates the connection between African-American civil rights discourse and environmentalism, that's a groundbreaking contribution. Nobody else has really hit upon that precise combination of things. So that intersection can do a lot for the scholarship, and even just potentially beyond scholarship, any activists or readers who are interested in intersectionality, which is a big buzzword these days in progressive communities. Mm-hmm. So your book is a good example of that. And also for me, you know, I think we both share this notion that regardless of how our careers progress, this is an important book for ourselves personally and for the contribution that we want to make to scholarship and to the culture that we live in. So I definitely feel a lot of the similar things that I think you've been saying that you felt about your book, with one exception. For me, motivation was never an issue. I never had to think, oh, I have to figure out what my motivation is. Mm-hmm. I always had a very strong amount of intrinsic motivation, regardless of the extrinsic rewards. So my passion for this subject, to me, made writing this book a very fulfilling and a very happy process.
Mm-hmm. I think that what we're hitting on is with the complete and almost total collapse and evaporation of the tenured profession, we have to reconsider why we produce knowledge in any way, why we publish, why we research. And that question of intrinsic motivation and extrinsic reward, I feel like we need to reconsider the relationship between those two and whether that's a binary that we can even go. It's almost analogous to everything you're talking about with American
individualism. Transcend that binary.
Yeah.
That's right. So I definitely agree with that, and I think there's at least three different like areas of impact that we can talk about. So there's the personal motivation and passion and interest. Mm-hmm. There's the extrinsic reward of kind of career and status and recognition. Then there's also just the cultural contribution, which is not quite the same as professional advancement. Like, you can write a book that lots of people read, even if it doesn't really change your own professional circumstance in a direct way. So whatever happens, there's lots of ways to look for the impact that your book can have. Of course, it's fulfilling to, you know, get a specialized audience to read your book. I'm fascinated to see, you know, what the people reviewing my book will have to say about it. And, you know, John, you've probably been paying attention to any reviews that might have come out about your book, too.
There's one on Amazon. It takes a while. I've been told you got to be patient. Like,
okay. That's good to know.
If you go to journals, if you go to their book, their, you know, the books that they have that are out that they want somebody to review, I mean, it's 2019. You'll still see stuff from 2014, 2015. So we're talking like many years of reviews kind
review
of trickling
backlog.
Out.
Well,
yeah.
Well, and that's something that I will certainly keep in mind, so I appreciate your perspective on that. Mm-hmm. But another thing is that I don't want to just stop with the personal motivation. Even though that was a huge driving force for me, I also want to have a broader impact. And even though my book is an academic book and it's not exactly going to crack the New York Times bestseller list, I also think that
if only.
There is a way to have a public crossover for this topic. And so I've been trying to make pitches to popular publications to try to get articles written that a broader audience would read, who would be also be interested in this topic and how it relates to American culture more generally at this particular time when concepts of American identity are so hotly contested. So that's what I want to kind of continue to focus on, is public engagement and beyond just academic or personal impact.
But I also think you could teach a class on this, I mean, as a start.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
We're at a university, and this would make an excellent class for English majors or elsewhere.
Absolutely. And I have no doubt that if there was a class with this topic, it would fill up. There's a lot of people in a university context who would really be invested in this. Mm-hmm. So I hope to get the chance someday.
You would have loved a class like that as an undergrad.
Well, of course, but, you know, that's why I got into this whole thing anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I was a religious studies minor. I took a lot of religion courses. Even though there weren't a lot of religion and literature courses in those days, now, you know, there's more precedent for that, and I think the climate is favorable for more of those kinds of classes.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Amen.
Yeah. Or a sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think that brings us probably to the end of our time together. So thank you, Kyle, so much for joining us. We're really looking forward to your presentation on Friday, March 1st, right?
That's
at 3 o'clock.
That's right.
Up in that big, long main reading room of the library. I think probably if you're listening to this, you know what I'm talking about. Am I missing anything?
Just congratulations on your book.
Yeah, hooray.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having this conversation.
And thanks, John, for joining us in our conversation and for editing the
thanks
podcast.
Thanks for having me, and I look forward to buying your affordable e-book, e-book version of this.
Certainly, I hope you enjoy it.
Okay. All right, we'll see everybody soon. Thanks for joining us.